Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Daily Friend Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Lorimer, and today joined by Mr. Gabriel Krauser. Gabriel, how are you doing?
Very well, Nick. Although today I see that I'm on the left, at least on my screen, and you're on the right.
So yeah, that seems to align with our ideological perspectives, I think, at least a bit. And of course, the master of balance and centrism himself, Mr. Marius Root, who sits in and underneath us, but no way underneath us. Marius, how are you?
Yeah, right on you guys. I've always been a fan of radical centrism, so.
Yeah, there you are. Right, so.
On that note, I must just say, I've been watching John Adams, an old HBO show about the founding fathers of America. And I think it was Benjamin Franklin who said that he was an extreme moderate. And by that he meant... Anyone who's not a moderate should have their testicles chopped off and sent to Congress because they lack the stones. Anyway, that's not swearing. That's Benjamin Franklin.
That's very good. That's very good. I saw one of our regular commenters giving us flack for starting late. that is because when I create the show, we actually still need to finalize exactly what we're going to talk about, so we do apologize if we kept you waiting. But anyway, we're going to try and get through a whole bunch of episodes. Gabriel, who is well known for his comprehensive analysis of issues, has promised us that he will be able to succinctly go through them, so we wait with bated breath to see if he can manage it.
I'm also looking out the window looking to see if any pigs are flying past, but I haven't seen any.
But let's get started off with a story that I feel like we've heard the general details of before, if not the specific details before, because there's very much a deja vu feeling with this. But the EFF has decided that it needs to go and protest a private establishment for what they say is racism and unfair labor practices. It also turns out that this establishment is an old age home in Pretoria, filled with mostly old Afrikaans people. So around 100 members of the EFF marched to... an old age home in Queenswood in Pretoria, and they said that they were protesting its racism and unfair labor practices. They handed a memorandum to the old age home demanding full compliance of labor legislation, immediate termination of security guards hired by the old age home following a strike by the workers, and, quote, open engagement with the employer on behalf of the employees. This is after the old age home had earlier in the month obtained an interdict against some of the unions for an unlawful strike. Well, this was not all that happened, though. What made the story a little bit more exciting, so to speak, was that a Afrikaner nationalist group known as the Bitter Enders, or the I can't say the Afrikaans pronunciation very well because my language skills are terrible, led by Steve Hofmeyr's son, Devin Hofmeyr, gathered outside in an open field next to the old age home and formed a sort of human chain saying that they were going to protect the old age home. They didn't actually block access to the old age home, but they were close to it. The EFF said they were going to break through the chain. There was much tension, people insulting each other. And ultimately, though, there was no violence and everyone just sort of went home without much drama, which I think is a fairly good end to the story. But yeah, we've seen this tactic that the EFF engages in of finding a labor dispute and then using it to generate racial tension. I've seen it in Northcliffe at Pick and Pays there. It's happened at companies across the country. Gabriel, your take.
Yeah, so I think only in South Africa do you have the almost battle of the pensioners' old age home. Only in South Africa do you have a political party that goes to storm an old age home to fight racism. And it's terrible. Just a small note. So what is going on there, the allegation that's more credible is that people are being paid below the minimum wage, that they're being paid 3,200 Rand a month rather than 3,500 Rand a month. Now, I was a freelance journalist for a while, and so effectively was earning quite substantially below the minimum wage and living off sort of oats. And I know it's very tough. It's important to note that South Africa is the only country, I did quite a lot of research on this, the only country in the world that is attempting to impose a minimum wage that's equal to the median wage. Median wage is the wage in the middle. So as many people earn less than that, as more than that, that was 3,500 Rand per month, according to Saab in 2019 or 2018. And then the minimum wage was set at 3,500 Rand. There literally isn't a decent economist outside of Gilad Isaacs at Wits. You know, there's no economist outside of South Africa who thinks that this is a good idea, because what it does is it prices people out of work.
Not even Piketty.
Not even Piketty. No. So I think that the race hustling is revolting. But on top of that, it should draw our attention to a sad fact of law, which is that as the law stands, we have the highest ratio of a minimum wage to a median wage and the highest ratio of a minimum median wage to unemployment. If you want more people to get jobs, you have to allow people to come and work for 3,000 Rand a month or 2,500 Rand a month or whatever it is, so that they can gain the skills and add the product so that people can really start regrowing the economy. Otherwise, what? 350 Rand a month grant. Come on.
Yeah, no, it's not enough. Maurice, your thoughts?
Yeah, I just want to point out one thing that, adding to what Gabriel said, the government itself, in its expanded public works program, can pay the people it gets to work for it less than the minimum wage. The government itself is allowed to pay less than minimum wage, but people who could go be doing a productive job and probably are willing to do a job for slightly more than that aren't allowed to go do that. So, yeah, it's ridiculous. But, I mean, it also shows you the EFF is – I think this lockdown has actually not been good for the party. It's been difficult for it to do its politics of spectacle, you know, storming out of parliament or thronging around somebody giving a speech and what have you. So they've had to find more and more ways to get into the newspapers and onto the front pages. We saw a little while ago when they marched the health regulation, health pharmacy regulation authority, whatever it's called, SAPRA. And I mean, now that we're breaking lockdown rules, I mean, you might not agree with them, but the EFF should be setting an example, and obviously they weren't. And they were saying also quite, you know, not so nice things about the woman who were running those, who was in charge of SAPRA, and they're apparently going to go camp outside her house and make sure that she accepts the Sinovac and the Russian vaccine and so on. So I think, yeah, this is just all part of the EFF's politics of spectacle. But I was not aware that Devin Hofmeyr was the person who was standing up to the EFF, but that is kind of like throwing petrol onto an already burning fire. So I'm not sure he's the best guy to, you know, try make things a bit less tense when it comes to race relations.
Yeah, I must say that the EFF is, I think, very deliberately doing this, where they find something, a target they believe will provoke some sort of emotional reaction. And they go after that in the hope that someone will show up and shoot at them, and then they'll have endless amounts of grievance and media attention.
They were likely hoping for another battle of Brackenfell, but from what I can tell, that didn't seem to turn out too well for them. I mean, they seem to be pretty, I mean, you know, there are pictures of, I mean, there was quite a well-known photo, and I think, of a EFF beret just in the middle of the road. Obviously, one of the people decided that his beret wasn't as important as not getting beaten up, and he abandoned his beret and ran away. When people also, I mean, those is going to, whatever had actually happened at the school, going and threatening pupils and so on is, I mean, that's just not only in my opinion. That's what happened at Brackenfell. And now also going to go intimidate some poor old people in Pretoria is also, not I don't think the greatest use of the EFF's time.
No, what are their most famous targets now? Dis-Chem, a pharmacy, place of medicine, schools, and an old age home. It's cowardly behavior.
Charming. Anyway, let us move on to our next topic. So, of course, we have been campaigning quite aggressively against the postponement of the election, the local government election. We think it's going to cause a number of serious problems for our democracy. Gabriel, what's the latest on that?
Yeah, so I think people just need to appreciate something about the procedure. So legally, registration has to be complete before proclamation. So the president proclaims the official date of the thing, and registration has to be finished before that, because you can't register afterwards and vote. And there needs to be some in-person registration. There's online registration, but there needs to be some in-person registration for people who haven't got online capacities. So the procedure is finish registration, then proclamation, then preparation from the IEC side. They need to, you know, print the ballots or whatever they need to do. And then you have the election. According to the IEC's report of last week, the minimum amount of time that they can do that in is 82 days, that preparation between proclamation and election. So the latest date at which a court could order them to hold the elections in time to respect the Constitution's deadline is August 6. And they said to me today that they have not yet appealed to a court, although they ruled last week Tuesday, they found that they should do that. And last week Friday said that they would do that. So they still haven't done that. But they said that they will do it by August 6. So in other words, they're going to go to the court on the day that the court has to make its decision and finish the registration and get the president to make the proclamation. There's no reason I can make sense of for this delay in between their decision to postpone the election and then their appeal to the court. It's very hard to see them as acting in good faith here. And if they are acting in good faith, it's impossible to see them as being competent to the implications of their decision. There's a word of warning to be added to this. So basically what I'm saying is the way the IEC has played this, they've kind of set it up so that it's going to be almost impossible for them to have the election on time. It's a little bit like a doctor who wants to do euthanasia and applies to a court to allow him to do it, and in the meantime unplugs the life support and says to the court, no, I seriously want to keep him alive until you tell me I can unplug him. But just before I go to court, I'm just going to unplug him. And, well, if he's already dead, then I suppose you can tell me that I shouldn't have done that, but it'll be a fait accompli. That's to be what's going on. That might tempt people to be complacent and think this doesn't matter. It does matter. There's one world in which the IEC is told by a court, your report was unreasonable. Your timing of then applying to the court was at a ridiculous delay. And so you have to do this thing as soon as possible. And if you say that the soonest you can do it is November 15th, do it on November 15th. If you say the soonest you can do it is December 5th, do it on December 5th. Then the IEC will be humiliated. And the Constitution will technically be bent or broken, because the thing must happen by November 1st. But everyone will understand what the problem was. The problem was the IEC. If that doesn't happen, if the Constitution is broken and no blame is properly apportioned for that breaking of the Constitution, then you set up the precedent that it can be postponed again. Then you set up the precedent for future elections that, if there's a riot before the election, we can postpone the election if we think that the ruling party is polling below 50% and it's not really a convenient time. Then you set up all the terrible precedents that we're very worried about. So it is very important. This fight matters. And sign on to our petition, share it with your friends. Right now, we're very engaged with the IEC, been part of the reason we were late to talking to our attorneys. We've been in conversation with them all week. This is serious.
Morris, anything to add?
No, I just think this is an important fight. And Gabriel's covered this well in the Daily Friend. There just doesn't seem any rational explanation why we need to postpone the election. Even the medical experts that presented the Mosoneke Commission, or the IEC Commission, as Gabriel insists that it be called, which is probably correct, said that probably at the end of October, we're probably going to be in a fairly low period of COVID transmission. So it really makes no sense whatsoever. They even say that if COVID's still around, which most probably will be, we probably more than likely will be in a fourth wave around February, depending on how many people have been vaccinated and so on. So it really makes absolutely no sense. And also, let's not forget that in April, Lem Mashinini, the IEC chief commissioner, whatever he's called, he said, IEC is definitely ready to have elections. Don't worry, everyone's calmed down.
And he said that again in May.
Exactly.
He said it again in May.
And this seems to all have gone out the window. And suddenly now the IEC is not going to have time to do this. I think from what it seems to be like now, I think 27th October is something not going to be feasible. The IEC won't have time. But I think second prize will be for the court to say, well, you've got to do it as soon as possible and say, by the middle of November, one of the cases, because a postponement to next year is very dangerous. And I think everybody needs to realize the gravity of this and needs to support the institute and whoever else is standing against the postponement of the election.
Exactly. No, so tell whatever political party you support that this is how you feel and that they need to do something about this. Right, so let us move swiftly on. Morris, a ANC ward councillor from your neck of the woods, Ekurhuleni, is included amongst the 1,600 people who have been arrested in connection with violent looting in the past couple of weeks. So, of course, my favorite of these stories was a CEO of a wealth management fund who was arrested. And now this ANC ward councillor was allegedly caught looting a bottle store in a shopping mall. Now, I must say, that is how you show solidarity with your constituents. You go and you make sure that you join in on the looting. So anyway, thankfully, the ANC says that it's going to bring him up for disciplinary charges inside the party. And they said in a statement, they wish to strongly condemn any acts of criminality attributable to any leaders and public representatives of the ANC. I can think of a few more they should probably include in that list, but, you know, it's better than them just ignoring this. Anyway, Morris, any thoughts?
Well, let me just say off the bat, I didn't vote for the guy, so please don't I'll be responsible for anything. But, I mean, it kind of tells you that you expect to hold your public representatives to a certain standard, and this guy certainly shown he's not, he's gone in and looted a bottle store. That's, you know, kind of, you actually just roll your eyes. But, I mean, if you look at a lot of people that the ANC still has it in quite important positions, it seems that looting a bottle store is actually not set on the, you know, broad, and in the bigger scheme of things, looting a bottle store is not such a bad thing compared to what a lot of other ANC leaders have done. So, but I mean, let's hope this guy does have the book thrown at him. This is not the guy that should be representing anybody in on the Ekurhuleni Council. But it's also, it shows, I think, levels of lawlessness and people not expecting to be held responsible for kinds of things that they do. Apparently, that in Mzunduzi, which is the Pietermaritzburg Council, I don't know if this is true, I'm not sure if it was confirmed, but people were using municipal vehicles to go do some looting. You have to laugh because otherwise you'd cry. So it's quite something. So yeah, but let's see what happens.
Benoni weeps.
Yeah, exactly.
Benoni weeps with their councillor.
No, this is in Maritzburg. In Maritzburg, they did this. From where our colleague Terence Corrigan is from. So look at the Natalian that we work with. You know, it's his issue. So, but yeah, it's just, I mean, like, as I say, if you don't, you got to laugh because otherwise you'll cry. But it just shows you something about, I think, the levels of lawlessness and impunity which a lot of people operate with. And I think it's, I mean, I'll say in Afghanistan, saying a fist for once a cop. And, you know, if the Secretary General of the ANC, Ace Magashule, is, you know, he, I don't want to get too anything, but he's probably a criminal. I mean, so you're not, I mean, it's not that, so why should an ANC councillor be not also get involved in this kind of behavior?
Morris, I don't know if you know, but Terence is actually watching the broadcast.
Yes, that's why I mentioned it. Yeah.
the real test, though, is, of course, when the ANC is choosing their candidate for the ward in the upcoming election. Presumably the court case will take a while to be finalized. And I would not be terribly surprised if we found that he had been reappointed as the candidate for the ward. So that'll be the true test of this. Gabriel, in 30 seconds or so, any thoughts?
I saw that in Newcastle, the Newcastle mayor, came to know stories about last year when I was covering a double farm murder there. He'd, amongst other things, been accused of being implicated in assassinations. There was someone who spoke out against
criminal syndicate within. May have been accused of assassinations.
Yeah. So anyway, and then insider said no, he probably didn't kill the guy or order his killing. But he definitely does is steal money. He's been officially charged, and in the article which reported this, it said, and according to the step-down convention or ruling of the ANC, that means he now has to step aside. His press office issued the statement that this doesn't apply to him, and he won't be stepping aside. So that's great. It also reminds me of when I was in Pietrateef and Kondor, there was an Induna very traditional guy who was just so outraged that there were municipal councillors and MECs who were marching with the mob that was throwing stones and breaking down businesses and attacking people. And he said, you know, because there'd been many days, it would be on and off, on and off. And then he'd speak to the municipal councillors in between and he'd say, what are you doing? And then their argument was, no, we have to be with the people. Otherwise it's worse. So maybe this looter was like, I had to go and loot with the people. Otherwise they'd
to restrain them.
Yeah.
Maybe he was there to stop children looting the alcohol, something like that.
And if you think of what Zuma's most erudite son said, loot responsibly, you know, I think that they really are, some people are trying to set the tone for responsible looting. And I want to take my hat off and swing it at someone.
Yeah, that's about right. All right, let's move on to an old communist. Jeremy Cronin. Of course, was formerly the Deputy Minister of Public Works. He's also still a member of the Politburo of the South African Communist Party. He has described the ANC's Radical Economic Transformation faction, the RET faction, as they're usually called, of associated with Ace Makashule and Jacob Zuma, as a network of right-wing primitive accumulators who are facing the prospect of going to jail. He said that the insurrection was hatched by right-wingers inside the ANC and they needed to be dealt with. It was an indication of a weak and compromised system of state and the capacity of the criminal justice system. He was delivering a virtual lecture as part of the South African Communist Party's centenary celebrations. He said also that the South African Communist Party agreed with the characterization that was given to events by President Cyril Ramaphosa, that the recent violence was an attempted counter-revolutionary insurrection. I quite like the old Marxist term of, what is it? Right-wing primitive accumulators.
Yeah.
He was 5 seconds away from talking about the capitalist running dogs, I think.
It's really one of the best things that I've ever done when it comes to understanding the country that I live in is reading the ANC's Umrabulla documents. And it sort of helped me to understand why Anthea Jeffrey is able to see the future. And it's not because she's magical, it's because she reads ANC documents. This is a strong recommendation to anyone. If you want to know what the future is going to look like, read the documents. And the Umrabulla discussion document, the latest one, says, you know, there's a terrible thing. People are saying that the C in ANC stands for corruption. Some people might even say the C in ANC stands for crime. And then it says, but the thing is that crime is really capitalism. And this is the problem. We have too many capitalists in the ANC. You can see all of these capitalists, they are the ones that are stealing things. And then I was like, oh, if you think capitalism is crime, then of course you're going to be anti-capitalist. And of course you're going to write, as was written in the Land Audit Report, as was written in the Ad Hoc Committee's first recommendations for how to change the Constitution, that one of the fundamental problems with land reform in South Africa for the last 25 years has been the capitalist elements, including bribery.
Oh boy.
So looting, and it quotes, like, it does this weird quote with Thabo Mbeki and then quotes some 21st century neo-Marxists who say capitalism is crime, and Marx himself said property is theft. So calling someone a thief is just another word for calling them a capitalist. And on this basis, every time someone does something wrong, they are a right winger. And then it all makes sense. I mean, it all makes sense to me. Why, when you have an economy that's shrinking for 7 years, you then decide to solve the problem by eroding property rights? Why you think you can get more investment while also saying, maybe we're going to take all your money away and give you nothing back? Why it makes sense that you have like 500,000 people murdered in the last 25 years and you say, you know what we're going to do? We're going to take away the guns because there's capitalists in the police that take these guns and then sell them to gangster capitalists in the Cape Flats. There's all these capitalists, even within the ANC. These capitalists, like, primitive, consumptive, anyone who makes money is a bit of a... is a capitalist, yeah. And that's what you need to get rid of. It's a thank you, Jeremy, for once again reminding us what a communist really thinks, and why, and why that idea has never worked, although it's been tried in every continent many times.
All right, let us move on to our last topic, and this is actually our most substantive one, and that is about that troubled country, Afghanistan. So, as I'm sure all of our listeners and watchers know, Afghanistan has been embroiled in conflict since long before the Americans arrived there. Since at least, I think, the 70s, it's basically been in a perpetual state of some sort of civil war. And now, of course, NATO troops, especially the Americans, are pulling out at the end of August entirely from the country. They had about, I think, 10,000 troops left in the country who were doing training roles, but even these are going to be withdrawn. And the Taliban, who, of course, were the dominant faction in Afghanistan during the 90s and were famous for hosting Osama bin Laden, are launching several major offensives across the country to try and topple Afghanistan's at least nominally democratically elected government. The country is in a pretty dire state. It's unclear who's actually going to win this internal conflict. The Taliban is claiming that it controls 80% of the country, although that's been heavily disputed. Some people say it's more like 40 or 50%. And the Taliban, as part of their agreement with the U.S., to see the U.S. withdraw, promised, we pinky swear, extra super duper promise, that we will not associate with Al-Qaeda anymore and will not work with any terrorists. They've also just promised the Chinese government, they met with the Communist Party in Beijing, saying, no, we swear we won't help any of the Muslims in Western China who are being oppressed by the Chinese government. We won't support any anti-Chinese things there. So the Taliban are clearly, I think, willing to promise pretty much anything at this stage in order to make sure that they can win this battle. Gabriel, your thoughts?
No, Ben. When did this happen that the Taliban became like the kind of organization that's respectable enough to be visiting Beijing and Washington and making oaths of good faith and being taken seriously by anyone? I think that
Just another thing, the Taliban have also promised the women of Afghanistan that we promise extra super duper that we won't be putting you back for forcing you out of schools and enslaving you again, as they did in the 90s.
Yeah, no, I think this is what happens when you go to war, as America did, and then can't decide whether you're there to win, or you get mission creep, mission loss, retreat without purpose. It was a mess. It became a worse mess. Now it's still a mess. It's very unfortunate. And the long version of that answer is to read that book that you've been reading, Nicholas, by
What's his name? McMaster wrote a book about America's strategic position.
Afghanistan has been called the graveyard of empires. And I mean, the British Empire pretty much came short there. The Soviet Empire did. So this maybe could be the end of the American Empire. But so one thing I just want to quickly point out is that John Watson, Sherlock Holmes's sidekick, his backstory was that he'd been a doctor in the Afghanistan war and he'd picked up an injury. When they rebooted the series 120 years ago, Holmes's sidekick, John Watson, could still be a doctor who'd been injured in the Afghanistan war. So that tells you something about the region and how the great powers go and meddle there and always come short.
So I suspect now there's going to be a major geopolitical struggle between the powers of Asia over Afghanistan. I wouldn't be surprised if India throws its support behind the Afghan government because it does not want to see the country controlled by the Taliban, who are allied to Pakistan, which is, of course, India's great enemy. Anyway, fairly tragic. I hope that the Taliban are defeated, but I think that that's a little bit optimistic at this stage. Anyway, that's all the time we have for today. And of course, we will see you next week for the Daily Friend Show. If you want to support the Institute of Race Relations, which funds the Daily Friend Show, you can SMS your name to 32823. You can see that on the banner behind me. And of course, you can also check out thedailyfriend.co.za for lots of good stuff. Also go to irr.org.za and sign our petition to keep the election in October when it should be held. We will keep fighting for that as best we can. Anyway, thanks very much, everyone. Hope you enjoyed the show. We did a whole bunch of topics today, and Gabriel actually, I think, did magnificently in keeping his answers succinct. So well done to you, Gabriel. excellent. All right. Cheers, everyone. Have a wonderful weekend.